Commercial banking whiz, Kate Kennedy, joins us on the Pressure Tested podcast today. Get ready to hear about her journey as a Polish immigrant, her family's construction business, and the ever-present juggle of work and motherhood. So before we get started on this girl math path, what even is girl math?
Well, girl math has been making waves on TikTok and the news. It's the hot topic of the day. It's really how women justify their spending, their time, and activity. So essentially, let's say you are, you know, you're buying a $400 dress and you wear it four times, and essentially, you know, by the fourth time, it's free. I don't know. That kind of be like, that's kind of depreciation, I think, right? Or you are trying to get ready at 3 o'clock for a 6 o'clock dinner. Again, takes us forever to get ready. Or you are, there's a good one I just read about, and I was like, dang, I do that all the time. Honestly, even like just spending money on, just go on vacation and spending money like you don't have a budget. It's like Monopoly money. Mm-hmm. So all that to kind of just justify how we like spend our money, time, and what we're doing.
Yeah. When was the last time you think you used girl math to account for a purchase?
Honestly, I cannot tell you how many times I use girl math daily. I was just thinking about this. I'm like, you know, honestly, whenever I go on vacation, my way of doing girl math is basically when you're on vacation, money is Monopoly money. Like, it's like your budget doesn't exist. I've also done girl math, you know, when you have to go to dinner and you got to start getting ready at 3:30 because it takes an hour and a half plus to get ready for a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting there and all that. Aside from that, though, you know, got to buy some nice clothes here and there.
Yeah.
You got to get your self-maintenance done. And when, you know, you wear it a couple times, you, like, depreciate the value. So basically, by the time, you know, you're done using it or wearing it, it's free.
Yeah, so my $200 jeans, those if I wear those 20 times, and it was really only $10 over time, that's really fun. My favorite girl math is, because this is so true for me, somehow my husband, like, unknown to me, will sometimes have cash. And every time I see that he has cash, I'm like, hey, where'd that come from? Why do you have cash? And he's like, oh, you know, I have cash because of this. I'm like, oh, okay. So the very next time I need to spend any money, I'm like, let's just use your cash. And he's like, all right, why do you want to use my cash? I'm like, because it's basically free. I mean, it's not in the bank. It's not money that we already have. But he's like, but it's money right here. This is money that we have. I'm like, it doesn't count.
You don't see it leaving the bank account?
You don't see it leaving the bank account. And I think that's really funny because there's like this old adage, and a lot of people will tell you that this is how you budget. And I used to believe this, but they would say, okay, so let's say you're going to spend, you know, you have $200 of spending money this week. Like, take that money out of the bank and keep it in your pocket. And that's what you could spend money on.
Yeah.
That would never work for me.
Isn't that the Dave Ramsey model? Something like that. I can't use it.
So. I knew I heard that somewhere. But for me, as soon as the money's like out of the bank, like that's when it's free. Like if I'm swiping my credit card, like that's when I'm spending money. If I'm handing somebody cash, like, that money doesn't even really exist to me, so.
Right, exactly. It's funny. We all justify our spending in all kinds of different ways, and everyone does it, but time is money if you think about it. So, like, whether it's how long it takes to get ready or, you know, looking at spending money for a concert and then going to a concert 6 months later, like, we all spend our money different ways and account for it.
I really like the idea that time is money. So, I'm a working mom. I feel like I do a really good job at work, but I am terrible at household, like, domestic stuff. I am terrible. Like, I'm that person that will leave, speaking of my, you know, $200 jeans, I'll leave those in the washer for like 2 weeks and be like, oh my God, I'm never going to get the smell out of these. And so, like, I started using this service called Hamper, where they basically come to my house, pick up all my clothes and bring them back the next day folded.
Genius.
And it's, you know, I was talking to this other mom about it. This one, she's like super good with budgets and she's just like, you know, the ultimate saver. I was telling her what I was paying for this. It's not even that much money. It's like for four Hampers, it's like $50. And she was like, $50? She's like, I can do that while I'm doing this, 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 and this. And I was like, God, she's right. She's right. I could do all that. But when it actually comes time to spend my Saturday doing that, I'm like, no, my time's too valuable for this. Like, I just can't spend it on doing laundry because time is valuable.
Right. And also as a mom, you have like a million other things you could be doing instead of doing laundry and folding it and like picking up little baby socks everywhere.
Oh.
So,
oh, yeah,
I totally get it. That's actually a steal. I'll need to get their contact info.
But yeah, it's really awesome. Good. I tell everybody I know about it and they always try it. And they're like, this is amazing because like. You know, there's people that were meant to, this is going to sound bad, but there's people who were meant to be domestic and meant to do laundry. I was not one of them. But when those people do my laundry, there's a big difference. Like, even my husband's like, oh, thank God you sent the laundry out.
Yes. Okay. It's like, yeah, happy wife, happy life.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that is the funniest thing ever. My husband will be the first to say, I hate anything domestic, like even cooking. So cooking, cleaning, laundry. I don't even know what else. There's a lot, but I am not about it. Yeah. I'd rather like look at 10 million financial statements to make up for it.
Yeah, I think that's totally fine. So, Kate, one of the reasons I asked you on the podcast today is so about a year ago, you reached out to me and you got my attention. You'd offered me tickets to something. And as you know, just the ultimate Swiftie, you offered me Taylor Swift tickets. I actually had Taylor Swift tickets for that weekend, but. I took you up. I got to take my both my girls to Taylor Swift, and it was just amazing. And it's just funny because I get hit up by business development people or software salespeople daily. I must sort through 5 to 10 emails every single day that are just people that want to give me something in return for my time. The majority of those people I blow off, and the ones that I do entertain, I end up becoming really annoyed by because they just, you know, even when I say, hey, I think that, you know, what you have to offer is really great, but that's probably a Q2, Q3, Q4 of 2024 project. And hey, check back with me then. You know, the next day they're emailing me this, and this. I'm like, well, hey, you know, like take a hint. But the reason I asked you here is there's something that I think you do better than anyone else I've ever met. And that's, I think you build relationships better. And so tell me a little bit about how you get to where you have the skill set of building relationships.
For sure. First of all, let me preface this by saying I feel like everyone's trying to sell you something.
Yep.
We're all selling, whether it's, you know, construction services, banking, insurance, everyone's selling something. So I think for me, relationship building comes down to the fact that I want to be your friend. I genuinely care. And I'm here for you. And I really approach my business relationships just as I would with true friendships. So, you know, I'll talk to my best friend the same way I probably will talk to you. Obviously, I won't talk about the same topic.
Yeah.
But I truly care. So I want you to succeed. I will be your biggest supporter. I will literally, like, when something comes up, I'm like, hey, have you heard of this company or have you heard of so-and-so, like, let's connect and let's figure out how to solve whatever problem you're having. So that is really key to my relationship. I want to be a resource. I want to be a connector. And I also want to be your friend. Yeah. But also, when you look at what, you know, a lot of business development people do is they do want to give you a little gift for your time, but then they spam you for, like, the next forever.
Yeah.
So I think what I like to do is really get to know people on a personal level, be their friend, but also do it in a fun setting. Like, no one wants to sit at an awkward lunch table or, you know, in their office or just in an awkward environment where, like, you know, you're asking all these questions, prying, trying to, like, learn, where it's a lot more fun to just go to a golf tournament or go to a concert and, like, really get to see that person in, like, a fun environment.
Yep.
And that's, I think, where a lot of values and great conversations happen, where ultimately you align with that person better.
I totally agree with that. So the first time, so I went to the Taylor Swift concert. You weren't there that time, but you invited me to the Gardenuity thing.
Oh, yeah.
Which was really cool. And I, you know, anytime I'm going to be in front of bankers, I, you know, sit down like the financial statements. I've got some of these key numbers in my head because I'm like, they're going to ask me this. They're going to ask me that. And so, you know, I fully prepared for that event because I assumed that you were going to be asking me questions. And so, you know, when I went in and, you know, I had a brief introduction to you, a brief introduction to, I think, your boss. And you were basically like, you know, I was just expecting this, like, what do you think about this? And you know, I didn't get that. And you were just like, we're, you know, this is a very salesy approach to things. You're like, I'm not, you know, let's build a relationship. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not here to ask you how your business is doing. I'm here to talk to you like you're a person. And I thought that that was really cool. I loved that. I also really liked that, you know, as somebody who is, you know, everybody's really busy, but me in particular, I just like don't have this natural, you know, thing in my brain where I'm like, okay, I need to check on this friend. Mm-hmm. And you do. Because a couple of weeks would go by after an event and you were checking on me with something else. And it's like, how do you remember to just like, of these connections that you meet, like, how do you remember to circle back to those guys?
Honestly, again, that goes back to me truly caring. Yeah. Like, I obviously have KPIs internally with my bank, but that's a whole separate thing where I truly check in on you just to see how you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, that matters. Like, yeah. I want to see, you know, is like, can we hang out soon? Yeah. Can we meet up? Let's chat about what you guys have going on. And it's really from a genuine perspective where I just want to know how you're doing. There's really not much more to it. It's genuine. It's authentic. And I truly care.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely what comes across for sure. You said, so we had a call yesterday and there's something that you said. You said that once you meet somebody and you know, and you guys become friends, you're their cheerleader. Like, you're going to support whatever they do. And I definitely have always felt that. Like, I feel like, and not that I'm going to, Garrett, I know you're listening, but if I was to go to a different company tomorrow, like, I feel like you would be there to support them.
Oh, yeah.
Not necessarily because you want the banking business, but just because you would be there to support whatever next step was right for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes across.
Right. And there's a couple of different aspects to that. So first, women need to support women. There's so much competition amongst women where we're all trying to just, I don't know, like, be better than one another, but really we're not going to get better and move forward if we keep tearing each other down. So can we just support each other and like be the cheerleader
to
each other?
I you know, you feel that too. I think that construction PMs feel that. I think everybody feels that as a woman. It's almost like women have this idea that there's only so many seats at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're taking up one, then it's a competition against anybody else who might also occupy a seat.
Right.
I've felt that my entire career. And you're right. Why do we do that? Because boys really do adopt this, like, good old boy system, mm-hmm. like, where they will support each other. And women just don't always have a tendency to do that.
Right. Well, it's like, first of all, very hard for a woman to get a seat at the table.
Yeah.
I sit in, you know, rooms mostly with men, mm-hmm. which they're great supporters and allies. But again, it goes back to the fact that women do have to fight really hard to get that seat. So,
absolutely.
However, that does not give them a reason to not support one another. Like, again, we can move forward way further if we build a supportive network, which is something that I feel like I've done. And even like through that garden event, I wanted to build organic relationships amongst women. There were attorneys there. There were founders. There were investors, CEOs, CFOs. And I feel like that's really where you can like build your network of, you know,
absolutely.
If there's an issue or if you want to like even have a mentor. Let's talk about like how important mentorship is for women. That's really, you know, a huge opportunity.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast is, you know, in my career, you know, I've had the boss that although they respected my opinion and thought highly of my opinion, they were so territorial about their own position that they were never going to let me move anywhere else in the company or even move into their role. Like I was just kind of kept in a little box, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the reasons I wanted to start the podcast is I want women to hear other women's stories and know that, you know, even though they may not have a mentor in their company, there's someone out there that's been through what they've been through and, you know, they're on the other side of it. They've, you know, they're a CFO or they're a president or they're really good at their job and this is what they did to get there. And that was one of the main reasons I even wanted to do this because I just don't think that you naturally get a lot of that as a woman.
Right.
But it's obviously a big problem to solve and I have not figured out how to solve it, but
big problem, but one step at a time, right?
Yeah, one step at a time,
but
for sure.
Going back to your original point about relationships, so again, as a banker, I don't want to just solicit your business. You know, yep. Like, I'm not trying to win it right away. It's a long game. So really with anything that is worthwhile, it takes time. So building that relationship from ground up is not going to be like a one day thing or like a 5 month thing.
Man, that's so true. So I just had this guy email me today that he emailed me like 6 months ago. And, you know, he said, hey, you know, we got your name from this person and we're really interested in your business and what all you have going on at Moss. And so, you know, I just, as the sucker that I am, I'm like, well, you know, let me tell you what we have going on. Let me tell you where maybe you could, you know, provide some value. And they pretty much just emailed me right back and they were like, no, we're only interested in your equipment financing business. And I was like,
oh, no,
then don't tell me you're going to provide value for me if you're only interested in one thing that we already have great trade partners doing. Like, you have to be willing to invest your time in the whole story before I'm just going to give you one certain part of my business. It just and that's what I met with every day. It's just so cold. OK, so one of the questions I had for you when I was thinking about this podcast is, you know, like, I'm a really, like, black and white person. Like, you're in the red or you're in the black. And it's like, how do you measure your success as a relationship manager?
Well, this, as you build and develop business, it's funny. I came from an underwriting role again, very black and white, there are a lot of rules and sat at my desk a lot and, I'm very analytical and I enjoy it, but this is more of a role where I am not at my desk. I'm meeting with people. I'm calling people. I am going to events late at night, all kinds of things like that, really that is one measure of your success. It's your activity, but you're controlling it. You're essentially in control of your destiny. So you're controlling your emails. You're controlling your events. You're controlling the number of people that you talk to on a monthly basis. Also, you're controlling your follow-ups. If you send an email or call someone and then don't ever reach back out to them again, it's like, what's the point of that call?
Yep.
So that's really like where success is measured, is controlling your controllables and just putting up the numbers. But also learning how to accept the fact that, you know, not everyone's going to respond.
Yeah.
But aside from that, you know, just having a conversation is key.
I think that's really, so as someone who just has the, you know, ultimate fear of rejection, and I will honestly not walk up to very many people in a social setting just because I'm like, okay, they're going to think I'm stupid or they're, you know, I have these like ridiculous fears. You know, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the brush off?
Well, I think,
I'm sure you get it, right? I mean,
well, I was just talking to you about how when I first met Garrett, I went to an event that him and another partner hosted, and one of our bankers was actually on the panel. It was honestly such a well done event.
The cash flow one.
Yeah, I almost didn't go because it was raining, and I'm like, oh,
I didn't go because it was raining. Bad. That's so funny.
Yeah, I hate driving in Dallas when it's raining, but really, it's, you got to take the risk.
Yeah,
go to the event. Totally, you don't know who you're gonna meet. One, two, say hi to the person you're trying to meet. Like, I literally had to overcome this crazy fear. I was literally shaking. I'm like, oh my God, he's there. I have to say hi and introduce myself. I've emailed him. I've dropped off things at his office. Yeah. Like, I need to do this. And it was literally terrifying for me to do this.
Yeah.
But I walked up. He was talking to, I believe, John Riggins and another person. So, you know, there's like the crescent. You're like, when you're talking to people, or if you're open for a conversation, you're kind of set up in a crescent. So the three people are like in a crescent moon type.
Okay. That's
thing.
Interesting.
That means that they're open for
to another person to cook. Yeah. Drink. That's really interesting.
Well,
I've never heard
they
that.
Were not in that like crescent formation. And I'm like, hey, I like just wanted to introduce myself really quick. First of all, I feel like Garrett's like the man, the myth, the legend. First of all, like he has such a huge following. But like, again, this took a lot of courage for me. And I was like, hey, I'm Kate Kennedy, you know, my whole thing. And I was like, wow, okay, I did it. And now I'm good. But like, just building up that like courage and confidence and taking the risk. Like, you could have been like, yo, who's this girl? Like, why is she even like interrupting this conversation? I just did it, and I feel like, I mean, he remembered me, so that's good.
He did. Yeah. You know, I think it's funny with Garrett because he's like 6'5".
So yeah.
So just the fact that he's so tall is kind of intimidating.
Right. That like was the number one intimidation factor for sure.
That's so funny. That's great. I think you're right about that. I feel like I find that in every networking event. If I just say yes, if I figure out how to get there, I always, you know, make that one connection. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I would have never met that person had I not said yes to this event. Yeah, I love that. So how much of what you do, like how much time do you think you spend on LinkedIn? Like how important is LinkedIn to what you do every day?
Yeah, LinkedIn is key. First of all, I feel like that's a new platform where not only can you like advertise what you're doing, it's almost like a marketing tool. But also, I do a lot of research on whether it's my clients, prospects, my business partners, so like service providers. I want to like stay on top of what they're doing.
Yeah.
You can find a lot of really great information, like whether it's industry updates, thought leadership, just be aware of what activities and events are going on in your area. So I spent, honestly, I can't tell you how many hours because I have not done that kind of math yet.
Yeah.
That would be like corporate math.
Yeah.
But I do use LinkedIn quite a lot. I feel like it's a great way to kind of, I try not to like overdo it, but like a way to share, again, thought leadership, share industry updates, and share kind of what you're doing in the area. Like, you know, what activities are you participating in?
Yeah.
Are you, like, how are you supporting the community? Like, what are causes that you care about? But I also do a lot of research on companies that I'm trying to prospect. Like,
yeah.
I will not ever show up to a meeting and not know literally, like, your end markets, your, you know, key capabilities, who the CEO, CFO, and, like, CAO, or depending on what your corporate structure is, but the key executives. And then just seeing what kind of connectivity do we have. There's like a comment, it's like the 6 degrees of separation or something like that.
Everyone
is somehow connected to someone you know, and I think again goes back to relationships and networking. You never know who you're gonna meet and how that person will somehow make your life better.
No, I definitely agree.
Hopefully
with
not
that. LinkedIn, I don't know why LinkedIn always feels like work for me, and I don't know if it's because, and it's so funny because I don't necessarily feel this way on other social media platforms. Like, you know, if I go on vacation, I'll post a story of, you know, me and my kids doing stuff. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's a slight hesitation of, you know, maybe this won't be well received or, but with LinkedIn, I am just like shaking in my boots. Like, I'm so nervous that it's not going to be received well, or somebody's going to think I'm an idiot, or, you know, it's like this whole imposter syndrome idea that, you know, oh, they're going to read this and they're going to think I am not worthy of my position at Moss. And so, you know, I do post on LinkedIn some, but to work up the courage to post is really hard for me. And I've noticed that in my downtime, while I may scroll LinkedIn, kind of just check for connections, when I'm really ready to shut my brain off from work, LinkedIn is not what I go to because it feels like work to me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like I need something outside of that because it feels like, you know, even because I, you know, I follow all these different people on LinkedIn, you know, the guy from Taylor Morrison, the big land development guy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. His wife has
the Blazer Company.
Yes. So cool. Women.
Yeah, I love that. But he's just really smart. And so reading his posts, like he posted something the other day and I had to, you know, almost like pull up the dictionary to like figure out what this guy was saying because he's just so smart.
Right.
And it's like, so when I'm reading this content, I'm like, sometimes it feels a little bit like, you know, self-improvement or work. And it's like, I need to get past that somehow and like just use LinkedIn as kind of more of a social media platform and not make it more about work. Like, I don't know why I feel like it's such a chore, but I gotta work through that.
I hear it. So it's like the holistic approach to that, because I feel like our generation really, again, does not want to be the stuffy room, does not want to be a robot.
Yeah.
We want to build genuine connections and we want to show that we are a holistic person. Like, we're not just, you know, service providers.
Yeah.
We're also like volunteering in the community. We're focused on our health. We want to just be good. We're almost like purpose driven. So there's a lot to it where I'm also trying to get past that kind of mental block where like, oh, this is all just like work related corporate things. But it does give an opportunity for others to see you more as more than just a service provider or
as a way to humanize
humanize
people in their roles.
Yeah,
I totally agree with that. So back to, you know, this business development role that you're in, you know, like how hard is it to, I mean, how often do you really start a conversation with somebody and end up being their primary banking partner? Like, you and I talked about this a little bit, and we talked about, you know, you made a really good example of what changing banks is like, and I'll let you take that over. Like, what did you say yesterday? It was really
Well, first of all, we all know how hard it is to change a banking partner.
So
a lot of banks stick with you through really tough times.
Absolutely.
And so that is how they build their trust with you and vice versa.
Yep.
However, switching banks is literally as hard, if not harder than moving on to a new ERP system. Like, that is just such a huge lift. Like, think of all the people that are affected. Obviously, your employees.
Yeah.
Your
new payroll check.
Hey, oh my gosh.
New bank reconciliation.
You got to get a new scanner.
New system. Yeah, new scanners. Mm-hmm. New place to go drop off petty cash. I mean, it's a huge change. I'd never heard it referred to like that. Like, it's almost as big as changing your ERP. Like, for us, like, we've been in the same ERP forever. Mm-hmm. We've been at the same bank forever, too. We love our bank. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's this huge change. Because you just, you know, a banking partner becomes so intrinsic to what you do every single day. Like, they're just, with banking, it's almost more of like they're closer to being an employee than any of your other vendors.
Right.
Because it's like, exactly, you just rely so much on them providing a certain service. So I think you hit the nail on the head with that. That's tough.
They're an outsourced advisor,
yes,
essentially. You know, they're, again, here to guide you through all the tough times and all the good times and through the whole life cycle of your company. So that's really, I feel like, where banks really do provide value. And that's where, like, we're not just here to just sell you like a quick like product. We're here as a, like, we're here to provide value. Again, cheesy comment, but we truly do care and we want to help your business continue.
No, I don't think that's cheesy at all. Me and Garrett were talking about this. So we have a new person in a business development role, and, you know, we were kind of had a big conversation about just like business development, but about, you know, like personal relationships between like husband and wife. And it's, you have to give without expecting a lot of return.
100.
And
love
I think that.
that
is just all relationships. Mm-hmm. And if you're not willing to do that, then you're not going to bring a lot of value to other people.
Right. Exactly. And you never know when the, like, something's going to click and it's like, wow,
yep,
that literally helped me solve whatever,
yep,
issue I was having.
Yep.
Or like, wow, this really made me think about, you know, how we're going to like look at our future growth. Like,
yeah,
are we just going to acquire a company? Are we going to like try to build a new city? How are we going to do that? So really, it's, you never know. Like, it's like one of those things that, again, just do it, take the risk, and you'll never know what the outcome is.
Yeah.
At the same time, you also want to be the person that, you know, the CEO or CFO thinks about right away when something comes up.
Because, yes, exactly.
Again, it's not about just selling.
But if you're not building that value over time, that CFO is not going to, you're not going to,
exactly,
be the person. Like the wonderful gentleman that emailed me earlier, he's the last person I'm going to think about, because it's like, because when I presented him with an opportunity to add value, he was not interested in adding, mm-hmm, value in that way. And that stopped,
right,
the relationship for me.
Yeah.
I mean, so basically between two emails, that relationship is no longer going to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
Yeah, it's tough. Okay. So, question for you. I feel like a big hot button topic, and gosh, I feel like we've been preparing for it, talking about it, dealing with it for 2 years now, is when is the recession going to hit, right? When are we going to feel this recession? And, you know, I think people say recession, they think 2008, and they think, you know, lives are going to change, businesses are going to close. And, you know, so from a lending perspective, how do you feel about the market right now in DFW for construction?
I feel like Texas is just so well positioned for continued success. We have a strong labor market. You know, obviously companies that are moving here or that have been established here are just finding ways to be more efficient and use their capital more wisely. So they're looking at, you know, being more efficient in their costs and expenses. And they're looking at ways to just streamline a lot of processes that don't have to, you know, be supported by actual people. So you see a lot of usage in
AI,
technology,
absolutely.
AI. There's a ton of awesome AI companies that are actually relocating here. So I feel like ultimately Texas and DFW is in a great spot. I mean, you see the suburbs expanding all the way up to pretty much South Oklahoma. And
yeah, I live in Prosper. Yep.
Right. I know. Like, how long is their commute?
You know, it really depends, but I mean, it's about an hour.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. You know, so we were like just thinking about, I don't know. I mean, for some reason, we have a really short attention span with real estate. So we like live in a house for like 3 years and we're like on to the next. So we're like, I think we're coming up on 2 years right now. So we're like already thinking about what's the next house, you know, where are we going to build? And I'm like, You know, the rates.
The rates,
you know,
exactly.
look at the cost of this house at 3%. No, now look at it at 6%. Like,
right.
It went from being affordable to not affordable. But then I hear all of this other stuff where it's like, there's still, you know, and we deal, and on the mechanical side, we deal with a lot of home builders. Mm-hmm. And none of these home builders are slowing down. They're still producing the same amount of inventory they were, because they say that we're still have such a demand in this area. And
yeah.
I mean, that's just like wild to me, that there's still this much of a demand. And I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head. Like, we're just in such a little bubble, uh-huh. right? Like, we've just, you know, streamlined businesses to the point in this bubble, and, you know, different political reasons that we can kind of survive recessions.
I mean, honestly, if you look at, you know, there's a huge housing shortage. Mm-hmm. There are people moving here every day. I think the most recently I saw that, gosh, there's been, like, it's like over 100,000 people moved to.
I saw that too.
DFW area.
It's like 95,000 people moved here in 1 year.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, I believe that. So there's like this bond that's up for Prosper ISD. And they said, so Prosper ISD is the fastest growing ISD in DFW. And every year they add 3,000 new students.
That is insane.
3,000 new students. Are you kidding me?
For reference, my high school was like 1,400 students, and that was big.
Well, my high school was maybe 400.
Yeah, so, like, that's, like, my graduating class. Oh, my gosh, tiny. But, yeah, no, you see that growth? I mean, there's new schools being put up everywhere.
You see
new roads being put up everywhere.
We do. You know, Utilities does a ton of schoolwork. Mm-hmm. We love schoolwork.
Yeah.
Schoolwork's, you know, it's kind of, you know, we know we're going to get paid. We do it's a ton of work with Pogue. We built the last Prosper High School. We're building the next Prosper High School with them.
Let's talk about those projects, too. Like, those are not, like, you know, it's not like a warehouse. It's a state-of-the-art facility.
Did you see Walnut Grove High School?
Yes. I'm like, wait.
That's the high school right outside my neighborhood.
That's crazy.
Yeah. It's insane.
But it's like, I'm excited for the future of our children, given these, like, amazing facilities. I remember being, like, you know, in, like, second grade, and my school did have air conditioning. And I'm like, what is this?
Are you kidding me? I went to, up north. That's
totally different. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's funny when you're from Texas, though. Like, we just went to New England and we stayed in this, like, you know, beautiful 100-year-old home, but it didn't have air conditioning. And it was like 45 to 65 outside. And we were miserable. We were like, oh my, like, I don't even think I left a good review, because I was like, invest in air conditioning, because it was just so hot. Like, in Texas, you have to have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. Like, you're used to, like, the 70-degree room, and you go anywhere else. Like, my husband's from the Chicago area, and so whatever we go, you know, like, his mom and dad, I don't think, have air conditioning. They have this huge, like, boiler-type furnace.
Yes.
They don't have air conditioning.
Yeah, the classic. It's like, it's so different, just in different parts of the country. But all that to say is, again, this region, I feel like the Sun Belt in general, is just so uniquely positioned for awesome success in the, you know, I don't know, like, who knows how long this will continue, but people are really post-COVID have reevaluated, like, their life. I personally also did.
Yeah.
And spent some time in Chicago, but moved back down to Dallas because this is really where it's all happening.
It is.
Again, schools, like, chip factories, semiconductors, hospitals, all that needs to support the people that are moving here.
Yeah.
And Texas has the space, they have the resources, favorable business environment, and the labor. One thing I do also want to mention is the fact that, you know, there's a TI factory going up.
Sherman.
Plant going up in Sherman. And then also the 25...
We did that. We didn't get it.
Oh, well, next time. I'm sure there's way more other...
We are doing a couple other big jobs.
Yeah.
Growth, like, is definitely happening there.
Think about, like, also, like, the $25 billion Samsung.
Where's that going?
Plant that's actually in Taylor, Texas. So it's south of here, but
I hadn't heard about that one.
Billion, like, that is insane.
I mean, you want to be in Texas. You want to be in Texas for the recession, for sure.
Exactly.
I mean, because it's just, we just don't feel it that much here.
Yeah,
it's wild.
So very good environment here.
What are you seeing with construction backlogs? Because I went to CFMA and I went to CFMA, the one in Denver, over the summer. And everybody said that, you know, backlogs are strong across the country. So what are you seeing?
Backlogs are continuing to be strong. There's a lot of investment in public infrastructure. Again, these plants and manufacturing facilities, data centers.
Yeah.
From a forecast perspective, in certain areas, again, Texas is almost unique to this. There is some slowdown going on in multifamily.
Yes.
Real estate. So, like, the smaller
commercial real estate.
Yeah. Commercial real estate. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's all to say it's not really slowing down everywhere.
Yeah.
It just depends on the region. But backlog is key when you really think about the future of your company. Mm-hmm. So we are still seeing strong backlogs. Again, depending on which part of the process you are, it might be slowing down. But again, backlog is key, and you want to make sure your end market side are diverse to best protect what's going to happen next.
Yeah, that's we do. We really focus on that. We service a lot of different industries. So far, we've really seen, we haven't seen multifamily slow down yet, because people are still moving here and they want to rent. And with rates, you know, as high as they are, a lot of people are renting. So we haven't seen that. We've also seen like the build to rent stuff really pick up. So a lot of build to rent stuff, a lot of multifamily. What we have seen really slow down is like big distribution centers. We haven't we have not been able to do as much of that work as we did in previous years. So I think that that's probably just maybe that has something to do with lending. I don't know. You'd probably
companies are being more cautious. Cost of capital is extremely high. I don't think, you know, we had free money for the longest time, and then it went from zero to like, you know, 5% plus. So
I know
it's not cheap anymore.
I wish we could go back to the cheap, like, you know, I read something, and we're probably a little off topic, but I read something the other day that was like, basically when rates were low, like the best thing you could have done with your money is buy like the most expensive house you could have possibly.
Yeah, it's free money. Yeah.
Because like now that house would be worth so much more. And I remember when I was buying with that basically free money, and I was like, still trying to like fit in this budget. Like if I would have thought about it that way then, man, my house would have probably appreciated $400,000 or $500,000 in the last couple of years. I know.
Right. Nuts. Yeah.
Construction is just a tough business, and you have a personal story about this. Are you comfortable sharing that personal story?
Yeah. So I know we talked about this in a different conversation where most construction companies fail within 7 years. I was exposed to the construction industry at a very young age. My my family actually moved here from Poland. And so they took a huge chance, you know, left their really well-paying jobs and wanted to provide a better life for my brother and I. So the construction industry allowed my family to build a life in the United States. You know, you see a lot of the labor that supports the industry that is building America every single day. And so while my parents are very highly educated, they had no shame in just going and doing whatever it took to build up a life.
What kind of construction company was it?
So it was just remodeling, repair, you know, like almost, like, I wouldn't say handyman, but it was like remodel, repair. My parents got into the real estate business pretty early on. So they were able to actually take advantage of home flipping. My brother and I were my dad's subcontractors. So my dad subbed his work out to my brother and I, and we actually got to work on probably like up to five properties that we flipped together. So we did everything from, you know, taking out trash to taking down plaster on the walls. And, you know, it's crazy. Back in the day, gosh, this was like probably like in 2005, 2006, the market was booming. Like you could buy a house, like a foreclosed house for like 70K.
Yeah.
And, you know, within three-ish months, you were selling it for 140, 150.
Dang.
Can we bring those times back?
Yeah, that'd be great. I would love to see that. So what happened with the company?
Yeah, so 2008 hit. Again, things just tanked.
Yeah.
And that was something my family was not prepared for. We had all these houses and we couldn't sell them. And we, like, no one was buying anything, you know, like demand was at all-time low. It was a true crash.
Yeah.
And
that was in Chicago, right?
That was in Illinois. Yeah. Okay. So Chicago really got hit hard.
Sure. Yeah.
And truly, I feel like it never really recovered.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It's not Texas. It's the market is completely different. I actually, my husband, totally my father-in-law, was talking to my mom, and he's like, you know, well, did the market ever recover? You know, were you able to like sell these houses eventually down the road? And it was like, no, like, it's still bad.
Wow.
So I think COVID really did help a little bit, but ultimately, the business tanked.
Yeah.
My parents lost
everything.
They lost literally everything. But they somehow managed to still pay for my private education.
Wow.
And still send me to college. And for that, I literally could not be grateful enough. But
so I understand. They're first generation immigrants.
First gen. Yep.
Wow. Very cool.
And but I think that like really does like kind of teach you the grit, you know, like you don't take no for an answer. you, like, I you're love committed that. To your success, and you're really the person in charge of your success.
Has any of the things you learned when you were younger, like your handyman skills, are any of those still present today? Like, can you, do you, would you feel comfortable? I know you bought, and you've talked about this a couple times, you bought a 100-year-old home. Are you remodeling that home?
Oh, yourself? My goodness. First of all, we grew up in a 100-year-old house.
Yeah.
So I have a very special place in my heart for houses like that.
Yeah.
You know, the endless projects, I guess.
Yeah.
But my husband will tell you, I put together all kinds of furniture. So, like, every piece of really? Furniture in our house, I've put together myself, which, again, I guess I have nothing better to do. I'm kidding. But I love just, like, putting it together. And then also, like, if there's a plumbing issue in our house, I'm like, let me identify the problem. And I do it. Like, we have a sink problem right now. And I'm like, I know what the issue is.
Oh,
but I
gosh.
Just don't That's have wild. Capacity to fix it right now.
That's super cool.
But yeah, so I do. Like, we actually also had a mini flood in our bathroom. I'm like, I can take the plaster down. I've done that before.
Really?
So,
wow.
Just again, there's always some kind of project. And again, with flipping homes, like, my dad self-performed a lot of the project.
Oh,
so he
cool.
didn't always hire people. Like I said, my brother and I were the subcontractors. So really, like, quality of work is key.
But how much harder is it to lend to construction companies?
Mm-hmm. So construction companies they operate in a cyclical, in a lagging industry, mm-hmm. essentially.
Right.
So cyclical industry, it's not always, you know, smooth sailing.
Yeah.
What is happening today might not be reflected in your performance for up to 4 years.
Yeah.
Which is kind of crazy if
you
think about
it. I agree with that.
Again, so what you do today really does matter 4 years down the road.
Yep.
And so what we look at from a lending perspective is, you know, you got to have cash. You got to have the liquidity. How are you going to support these projects? We obviously look at all your financials, but like, cash flow is key. With construction companies, a lot of cash flow is really tied up in retainage and overbillings and so on. So it's really important to manage that in a way where it will set you up for future success rather than failure. There's a lot of companies that, you know, they get started and they start growing like crazy, mm-hmm. but they're always in that cash crunch because they literally just don't have the capacity to do all the work that they're bringing on.
Yep.
So whether it's, you know, labor or mm-hmm. materials.
Think yeah.
of all those are probably the two biggest things that affect your margin.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they change all the time. You know, there's a lot of volatility. COVID caused some serious supply chain issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you just have to really be aware of those risks. Also, we also look at the types of contracts. There's a lot of different types of contracts that, you know, construction companies operate under. There's the gross guaranteed maximum mm-hmm. price, fixed price, lump sum, but again, that's where, like, some of the, like, costs come into play, where that could put a sub underwater, where, like, the costs just spin out of control. So all that to say, make sure you got good estimators and have a good risk management system in place to manage some of the risks associated with bidding and managing costs.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the thing that, you know, if we started, or Garrett started Moss Utilities in 2016, right at the end of 2016, I came on in 2018. And from the very first moment that I came on, I immediately felt the constraints of retainage.
Mm-hmm.
So especially when you're a newer company and you're figuring out your processes, you're figuring out your efficiencies, you don't have the best buying power yet. You know, especially for an industry like utilities, if you're getting 10% out of the job, you're doing a dang good job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because especially in those first couple of years, the only way you're going to really get in the door with most people before you prove yourself is by being the low bid.
Yep.
So you go in, you're low bid, you're taking a job at 8%.
Right.
You don't have your project manager processes in place. You don't have your field support in place. And now all of a sudden your job's sitting at 6%, 10% of your money's tied up. And then it's like, I'm not going to get that money for, you know,
a long
350 days. Or,
right.
You know, like, even our DSO to this day, I mean, luckily we're on the other side of it but you basically have to figure out how to get through those first 2 to 3 years of all of your money and all of your profit being tied up.
Right.
And it's so tough. And I mean, that's definitely why, you know, Moss Utilities had a hard time. We were really lucky to have an interim CFO that came on that, you know, put us in the right room with the right people that were able to structure a deal for us. I think that, you know, when I talk to people about, you know, how hard it is to start a construction company or how hard it was for Moss, and I look back on the things that have happened, I really think that it's so key. Sometimes it's so key, the rooms that you get put into with the right people.
100%.
Because if the right person can see it, can see what you're capable of doing, the whole thing changes. And that's what happened to us. Because at that point, we weren't bankable. You know, I mean, I'm sure you deal with this all the time. I mean, I'm sure you have a lot of people that you want to bank. They're just not bankable. Like, how do you really define? And, you know, somebody who's been in, like, I've been on both sides of it, right? Like, I've been through the time when a bank wouldn't sit down with utilities, and now we're on the side where all the banks want to sit down with us. Now we're kind of going through it with our heating and air conditioning company. But, like, when you look at a company, you're like, it's just not bankable yet. Like, what do you see on the financial statements?
Well, in the middle market space, you see that a lot. And that's where kind of like learning how to scale and streamline a lot of things comes into play.
Yeah.
Like, that should be your main focus. But I never want to be the dead end. So,
yep.
And I also never want to deliver bad news. I know sometimes we have to, and it's very tough. And I also want to be a resource. But sometimes just like, no, but.
Mm-hmm.
So let's figure out a way to like help. Yep. Or not yet, but soon.
Yeah.
And so obviously banks want to see a profitable business. They want to see good assets. They want to see cash, good liquidity. But if you're not profitable, there's usually a reason. So let's figure out why that is. And like, let's hear the story and then see how we can help. And again, it might not be from like, you know, we're not going to give you a line of credit today.
Yeah.
But it could be like, let's figure out like, why is this happening? And like, again, how can we be helpful? I'm not getting paid for that. Like,
yeah.
I'm not a commission-based person, so or salesperson, but but I want to help again.
Yeah.
So being profitable is definitely key, but having just the resource is going to help you ultimately down the road.
How important do you think it is for a company that's just starting out to, like, and I, you know, kind of shared this with you before we got started, but how important is it when somebody presents you with a set of financial statements for you to see their WIP? And to see that they have a WIP and they understand what the WIP does for their business. Like, how important is that?
Well, that almost goes back to like the having the right controls in place.
Yeah.
So like the fact that they have a WIP is like a
check
win.
Mark. Yeah.
Check mark. Yeah. Win. Like, yes, we did it. Yeah. Let's go, team.
Yeah.
That is amazing because that helps us as a banker tell our risk partners a better story. Like, we can't tell the full story if we don't have, you know, a WIP.
Yeah.
That helps us, you know, seeing a WIP and seeing how y'all are performing on projects, seeing your backlog, pipeline, so on.
Yeah.
That helps us kind of predict how y'all are going to do, like, in the next year or so. Like, how are you going to support your operations?
Yeah.
But ultimately, again, comes down to, like, us being able to tell the story on your behalf. We're your advocate.
Okay, that makes sense. So, how does the bank look at the underbillings and overbillings? Because I think that a lot of people that are going to, you know, tune into this podcast are mostly people that, you know Garrett and know what Garrett's done. And so, you know, when you present a WIP to a bank, and let's say you have, you know, $3 million of underbilling, and how do you guys kind of handle that situation? Like, what is your advice back to the company?
Yeah. So underbillings aren't bad.
Yeah.
They're an asset.
Yeah.
However, you got to have cash.
Yeah.
Like, you just have to have it.
Yeah.
Cash is king. We all know it.
Yeah.
The way that, you know, underbillings works is that you bill for work that hasn't been done yet.
Yeah.
So it's like, what if there's a change? You know, what if there's a change order that comes in? What if, like, prices of your materials go up significantly? Again, it's like the unicorn event or something crazy that happens. But again, you don't know. No one knew COVID was going to happen. So we don't want to see companies with high overbillings, low cash.
Mm-hmm.
Like, essentially what you're doing is you're using overbillings to finance your company's operations.
Yep.
And that is risky. Like, again, due to those factors, like, you don't know what's going to happen with these projects that you've overbilled on that has, you know, you haven't paid the work on yet.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. The light bulb moment really went on for me at CFMA this year. I was listening to this guy speak who had, who's been the CFO of a big utility type construction company in the Northeast for, you know, 20 years. And he said, you know, it's fine to have a lot of overbillings as long as your cash balance reflects your overbilling amount. And when he said that, I stopped and, you know, first thing I did was pull up financial statements and like look at her cash balance. I was like, let me just see how far off this guy is on this, you know? And then I was like, this. So now every time when I really look at overbillings, I immediately go back and kind of measure her cash balance to it. And I think that that is key because it's, yeah, push your overbillings, push billing, do it. Yeah. Get as much as you can. I mean, but if you don't have that cash on hand,
it's not really there.
Where's all that money? Right. Yeah, you know, you're funding that money for your operations at that point.
Exactly. Totally. It's almost like a credit card, but not really. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's not really in your bank account.
I think that term that I always use is it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's a good one.
Okay, so I kind of want to switch topics now. And I want to talk about what it's like to be a working mom. And just kind of... I feel like this is such, you know, and I'll use my own personal experience with this, but like, I feel like I can come to work and I can kick ass at work. Mm-hmm. I can leave work feeling like I just dominated. I got all my stuff done. I led a meeting. I got somebody to see my way on something. I produced this, I did this. But then I show up at my daughter's school and, you know, my teacher tells me, hey, so you're the only mom who still hasn't signed up for this. And I'm like, sorry.
Oh, no. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's like, so sometimes I feel like I can only do really good at one or the other.
Uh-huh.
And it comes with a lot of guilt. So, like, what's your experience been being a professional while also having a child at home?
Oh, my gosh. Does the guilt ever go away?
Please
tell me it does.
No, never goes away.
Honestly, this is just, like, such a huge topic that I feel like is not talked about enough. Mm-hmm. Because, first of all, life is just so expensive. So, like, it's almost becoming harder for, you know, women to almost, you know, to stay at home and be there for their children, which is very sad.
Yeah.
If I could, I would be with my daughter all the time, but it's really hard work also.
Yep.
So I like going to work. I love being a mom. I love being a working mom, and I love working. So all that to say, I am guilty all the time. I'm guilty about, you know, maybe not being able to show up to the office until a certain time, or like having to leave slightly earlier to pick my daughter up, or, you know, just all the things that we do on the weekends. It's like, first of all, again, being a woman, there's so much self-maintenance that goes into just like looking presentable.
Yeah.
So like,
that's so true.
My Saturdays, like when our 18-month-old daughter naps, I'm literally running errands, like grocery shopping, which I know you can get delivered, but hair, nails, makeup, spray tan, whatever, like whatever you need to do.
Yeah, whatever you need to do.
You have a 2-hour time frame, and if I ever go over that 2-hour time frame, sometimes it's less, I just feel like the worst parent ever, and I just like want it to go away. That feeling just sucks. But like you said, you know, it's hard to just like crush it at both things. You can't. Women are great at multitasking, planning ahead, being intentional. But God, like, it's been quite the learning experience that I was not ready for. So I just try to do my best every day. And like, I am very hard on myself. I'm stubborn, you know, all the negative words. Yeah. I want to crush it at work, and I do. But then I also have to crush it at being a mom. So the hours from like 5 to 7 are just complete chaos. Like, I'm doing 7 things at once, but I want my daughter to have the best life. Like, it almost like gave me like new, like a new drive, and the determination to provide for her and give her all the things that I didn't have growing up, which I'm grateful for all the things that my parents were able to do. But at the same time, I want my daughter to have a life that, you know, maybe isn't what I had.
Yeah. I mean, I think that most working moms have a very similar story. And so, you know, it's a trade-off. The only thing that I will say, because I feel like every year that I get a little bit older, I give myself a little bit more grace.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really hard thing for me. I mean, you can talk to anybody here, anybody that's close to me, and I'm always my worst critic. There's nothing that someone else can say to me that I haven't said to myself a lot harsher. But at some point, you have to be okay with the decisions that you've made. Mm-hmm. Like, you've made the decision to, you know, work so you can provide a different lifestyle that you had. And, you know, that was a conscious decision. And because of that, you may not also get to be the president of PTO. And that's okay.
Exactly.
It's okay. And, you know, it's okay to have that guilt. And it's okay not to have that guilt. It's okay to go and get your nails done and get a massage and take care of yourself. Because if you can't take care of yourself and not feel guilty about it, you're going to have a hard time taking care of anybody else.
Exactly. 100%. If you're not your best self, really.
Then you're not gonna be the best at work. You're not gonna be the best at home. And I've had to give myself a lot of grace. You know, Emily, my daughter, she gives me a hard time. She's like, oh, you know, she has a friend named Cora, and her mom is like literally queen of the PTO. I love this mom. She's so sweet. She's a stay-at-home mom. But she is at that school all the time. And, you know, Emily always says, you know, I really want you to be on the PTO, or, you know, come eat lunch with me. And I'm like, hey, you know, I have 4 meetings today. And she's like, you always have meetings. I'm like, I know. You know, it's like, I know that I always have meetings. And I'm like, but, you know, one day I hope that she just looks back at me and she says, hey, you know, my mom was successful and she was, you know, she did everything she could. And, you know, that's just, and at the end of the day, I can't feel guilty about the decisions I've made and that I'm trying to, but it's tough. Like, I think that women go through this. Women are so hard on themselves. They're so hard on each other, so hard on themselves. But, man, I hope that, you know, for me, I hope that I figured it out. I hope that you figure it out.
I know.
You know, because it's, we really can't be the best parent if we don't give ourselves a little grace.
Exactly. And really, I feel like women set very high expectations for themselves, just in general. And we feel like we have to meet these expectations. But really, just, like, being reasonable and really just, like you said, you have to give yourself some time.
Yeah.
You have to take care of yourself. Like, we're in it for a long haul.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it comes down to. And, you know, ultimately, like I said, I take my job very seriously. I love my job. But if I can't get to one email, like, at 7 p.m., it's going to be okay if I respond to it tomorrow. So, again, that's kind of where giving yourself a little bit of grace comes in. But, again, I love being a mom. It's really fun. I almost feel like I get to be a kid all over again. We go to the zoo and, like, I don't know, to the beach. We can splash around. It's so much fun. I love it.
Well, your daughter's at a good age. I spent 15 minutes this morning arguing with Emily over what she was going to wear.
Oh, my gosh.
She's, like, in this phase where she just wants to wear baggy clothes. And
that's so funny.
And we, like, argue about. So I was going to text my friend. I was going to text Garrett's wife, Haley, because she, like, always outfits her kids in these really cute clothes. I was going to text her and be like, enjoy putting your kids in whatever you want to put them in.
Yeah.
Because it's eventually going to end. One day there's going to be a mini adult telling you that she's not going to wear that. So
that is so funny.
That's something for you to look forward to in later years.
Oh, goodness. Don't tell me that. But awesome.
Well, Kate, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed this conversation. It was so fun. I hope to have you back on the podcast soon.
Love it. Thank you so much, Kelly. I truly enjoy spending time with you and having these conversations.
Thanks.